Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of the In the Crease Podcast. I am Dan Abern, contributing writer at Inside Lacrosse. We got a little bit of a shakeup this AM. Kyle Devitt was not available to record, so we got the next best replacement, Terry Foy, our publisher. How are you doing, Terry?
I am not Kyle Devitt. I'm doing great, Dan. I am very fired up to be in this role. Traditionally, I'm in the host seat. I'm in your role.
Yeah.
This is my opportunity to analyze, and I'm going to bring some heat today. I'm really fired up to do my best Kyle Devitt impression.
We asked Matt Kinnear to do this podcast, but he said he would not collaborate with someone who preaches quote-unquote Pearl Jam blasphemy. So we had to get Terry on.
Yeah, that's going to be a deep hole for you to dig out of. Your penance is still being paid. I think you might have to actually like take him to a show or buy a Pearl Jam poster or something to that effect in order to actually start to chip away at the huge chip on his shoulder.
Write an album report on 10.
That's right.
We'll see. But Terry, it was a huge weekend for playoffs. We got NBA playoffs. We got NHL playoffs. The Caps broke through last night over the Leafs.
The Cleveland Cavaliers advanced to the second round. The Boston Celtics are now tied 2-2 with the Chicago Bulls, which I'm sure Kyle would mention if he were here. He's probably pretty upset that the Bruins were eliminated. So a lot of up and down in the Inside Lacrosse fanship world.
And while there's no playoffs going on in lacrosse, there were a lot of games this weekend that felt very impactful, that they were almost playoff games.
Yeah, man, I don't know what you're talking about. Friday night and last night were de facto playoff games.
Yeah.
So let's dive in.
Yeah, let's go straight into what I thought was the biggest result of the weekend, probably where the most shakeup happened, and that was Ohio State 11, Maryland 10 in overtime. This game came down to two words for me, Jake Withers.
Yeah, he was excellent. I mean, I think that when we've spoken about Jake Withers so far this season, there have been two themes that have emerged. The first is, despite being the Big Ten specialist of the year in 2016, he was a lesser known quantity than a lot of the other faceoff guys coming into the season. A lot of the league guys, whether you're talking about Trevor Baptiste or Ben Williams or even Stephen Kelly, who obviously led the Tar Heels to the national championship last year. On top of that, he's the future of the faceoff position for the Canadian national team.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got this versatility of style. Those combined, I think, to make so many interesting storylines emerging around this issue of Ohio State's faceoff performance and their ability to build their team, both in terms of the roster composition and in terms of their style of play around Jake Withers' performance. And obviously, you know, with the exception of the Penn State game, you've seen his results correlate very closely with Ohio State's results.
Absolutely. And I got to say, you know, we previewed this show on our Friday Game Day Live show, and I kind of saw this one coming. You know, a lot of people have pegged Withers as second-best Fogo in Division I after Trevor Baptiste. I'm 100% on board with that. You know, Ohio State wins their games at home pretty convincingly, and just watching this game, I kind of felt like, you know, Maryland had that possession disadvantage and that they were just doomed playing that much defense in this game. So this one was definitely recipe for an upset, so to speak.
It's interesting that you point out Ohio State's home field advantage, and obviously we've seen it. I think that after that Denver game, you know, people came away with it like, wow, Columbus is apparently a difficult place to play. Mm-hmm. You know, the joke has always been you're playing in front of 100,000 empty seats when you're playing in the Horseshoe. What do you think is actually the contributing factor there? Because, like, in pregame, Maryland posted a video of them running down the tunnel. I was actually at this Maryland-Ohio State game 2 years ago that went to overtime and the Terps emerged victorious. That was before the spring game. There was 75,000, 80,000 fans in the game to see the Maryland game-winning goal. The environment was electric, and you definitely, that video clip of Maryland coming down the tunnel reminded me of when you go to Ohio State, it feels like you're playing in a big-time football environment compared to really anywhere else, including Maryland Stadium, which is no slight to Maryland. It's just that there's, I think, a little bit more familiarity with those grounds among the lacrosse world. And so do you think that that is a part of it? Do you think that the fact that playing in the Horseshoe feels like playing in a big-time football game is a part of what gives Ohio State a home field advantage?
Possibly. I think, you know, the difficulty of traveling to a place like Columbus, especially for a lot of these Big Ten teams, it's quite a hike. And then also, I feel like a lot of people talk about this, but playing with 100,000 empty seats somehow distracts the players. They're like, whoa, this is kind of creepy in a way, like a little bit hollowed out, so to speak. I've heard that. It is very interesting that, you know, Ohio State has come away with quite this home field advantage, so to speak, in this season. It's just been very interesting, and that's actually why I think that, you know, Ohio State's got to be the favorite to win the Big Ten right now. They've beaten Hopkins, they've beaten Maryland, the tournaments in their house, you got to like their chances.
Yeah, well, I want to dive into some of the tactics of this a little bit.
Absolutely.
To me, this started with how difficult it was for Maryland to score goals. Now, granted, yes, they got to 10, so it's not to say that, you know, it was their worst offensive performance of the season or anything like that, but it just really reinforced the narrative that without Colin Heacock, Maryland's offense, it's just not easy, right? It's hard going. It's a slog. And, you know, he did participate in this game, but he did not start. And based on what I was able to see, it didn't seem like he played a ton. You know, at one point he was out of uniform and then finished, you know, scoreless. So clearly was not his normal self. And I think that that physicality that he and Rambo combined to bring to the offensive unit is their biggest matchup advantage. And without him, I think a lot of attention gets paid to Rambo. And, you know, defenses have the opportunity to create different types of matchups to throw at Rambo and keep him off guard. They can slide to him really fast. They don't have to worry about Heacock running through a second slide with his, you know, frame and size. And I think that all of it amounts to, without Colin Heacock, Maryland is a different team. And so to the point of, what are we going to see in the Big Ten tournament? He's got 2 weeks to recover and get ready for that. Now that Maryland is still playing for, I mean, don't get me wrong, Maryland is playing Johns Hopkins this weekend. It is a rivalry game. It is clearly very, very important to that team and that campus. That being said, now that they are no longer undefeated in the Big Ten and they're in a race for the number one seed, I think that there's a little bit of, let's just make sure we're right for the conference tournament at play. Yeah. And so I wouldn't be surprised if it was like, all right, we're going to pull back on the reins a little bit, see how Colin recovers and whether or not he's available to play this week. We're not going to risk it. And let's get make sure that we're ready for Columbus. And ultimately, I think that that's huge in terms of who I would call the favorite in the Big Ten tournament.
Absolutely. And one thing I found out this morning is that if Ohio State beats Rutgers next week, then Maryland is going to play back-to-back games against Johns Hopkins. They'll play in the regular season on Saturday, and then in the opening round of the Big Ten tournament as the number two versus number three seed, the regular season game would determine that, but it's irregardless, so to speak. So, yeah, you know, we'll see how that, you know, Saturday matchup plays out. There's not too much there's not too much to be won, so to speak, because you know who you're going to play if Ohio State beats Rutgers.
And I think that the inverse is also true in the sense that, you know, if Ohio State is going to be in a really odd, interesting first round matchup, regardless of who they play. But if they play Penn State, I think that's a really interesting rematch in the sense that, you know, Penn State beat them. They have the confidence. They know that they can beat this team. That will not be true for Hopkins or Maryland. So what does that mean in terms of beating a team a second time? What does that mean in terms of, would Ohio State rather play Penn State than the other two just because they know that they're going to have their team's attention heading into that one?
Possibly. I mean, I just look at it either way. You know that Ohio State's probably going to win the face-off battle because they've done it against all the other three opponents in the Big Ten that have made the tournament. So I think maybe, you know, Ohio State, if they do play Penn State, they say, hey, we're in our house this time. We know what Withers can do at the X. This should be our game.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, Trey LeClaire, 0-0, and Ohio State is still able to win. Obviously, you're not going to get five goals out of Eric Fennell every single game, but you know he's certainly been excellent in some of their big performances so far this year. What did you make of that? Do you think that that's a positive or a negative for Ohio State, the fact that they showed that they can win without significant contributions from the freshman attackman who to this point had been their leading scorer?
Well, Mark Dixon made a good point on the Rutgers-Penn State broadcast last year about Ohio State, and that it's very much a pick-your-poison kind of offense to game plan around. And it was very clear that Maryland came into this game saying, we want to neutralize Trey LeClaire's chances. And that actually left, you know, Fennell with some opportunities. Actually, it felt like Maryland played him pretty well, but he canned his opportunities when Maryland gave them up. We saw him go to his right hand a lot in this game. He actually tried to deliver the game winner with his right, working with a kind of Canadian kind of, you know, wing play. But, you know, I do think that's very much a positive. Trey LeClaire, I do think, is their most dangerous player, but you do have to kind of choose who do we want to take away, Eric Fennell or Trey LeClaire. And I actually think if there's a rematch in this game, Maryland might attack that attack unit differently.
Let's talk about the game winner.
Yes.
So you can make the argument that it was fluky because it was a rebound goal that fell to a relatively uncovered shooter. But on the other hand, it was off of a pipe shot. So you can make the argument that the ball should have gone in, given that Eric Fennell, right-handed, no less,
yeah,
a Canadian shooting with his off hand, hit the pipe. So what's your take? Was it a fluky goal, or did Ohio State deserve to win on that one?
Well, I was watching with my dad, and he basically said on the replay, we were watching the replay, he said, man, what a lucky bounce. And I said, yeah, that was pretty lucky. But I also made the observation that it was almost as if Eric Fennell used the pipe to assist Johnny Pearson, because the bounce to Pearson was so perfect.
It was kind of like it reminded me of that really memorable Kobe Bryant airball that fell right to Metta World Peace for the putback in whatever NBA playoffs series that was. One of those. Oh no! Can't believe that went so awry. Ooh! Game winner.
Yeah. I mean, you can say that that particular shot was lucky, but I think I went into the overtime period thinking that there was no way Maryland was going to win, because, first of all, they were not going to get the ball with the way Jake Withers was playing. And once they did, you knew that Ohio State was going to can their shot.
And so now Ohio State, 12-2, kind of in the catbird seat relative to the Big Ten tournament. They've got one game left against Rutgers. And it, really interesting matchup in terms of style. Not sure, you know, with Rutgers being eliminated from the Big Ten tournament, you know, on the one hand, you could imagine them being a little disappointed going into that one. On the other hand, they have an opportunity to top five win that'll really bolster their at-large resume for the NCAA tournament. And they're not eliminated from NCAA tournament consideration by any margin.
No, and that's a great point you make. I feel like for Rutgers, that is a de facto playoff game for them, because they're really holding on to that at-large selection. Their victory over Army has decreased in value. Their victory over Princeton is not so great anymore. So obviously a big game for them. All right, let's move on to our second game. But before we do that, we got to talk about one of our sponsors. And we have both been able to feast upon our sponsor with this one. Kyle has not, which he's probably a little bit jealous of. But Blue Apron, we have both received packages. We have both cooked the food. We have both eaten it. Tell me about your experiences with it, Terry.
Yeah, well, I actually I cooked up some shrimp fried rice, Szechuan, I believe, last night. And it was delicious. So my wife and I are not big seafood people. It was the first time I'd ever cooked shrimp in my home. And it was really interesting, because the aroma that I was left with after finishing, I was like, man, this smells like one of my friend's house. And now I'm just convinced that like all my friends have been cooking shrimp, and that's why their houses smell the way that they do. It was delicious, though.
Yeah, my first experience was I made, I believe, Zatar spiced chicken. It was delicious. I don't know what kind of like coating they put on it, but it was great. It tasted almost like a fried chicken kind of meal, but without all the breading and the fat on it. And then I also had some of their shakshuka last week. Shakshuka is like an Israeli / North African dish where it's basically an eggs in the middle of a tomato and kind of meat potato base. It's delicious. You can eat it for breakfast or dinner. I had it for dinner. It was great. I'm really enjoying what we've gotten out of Blue Apron so far.
I think one of the things that I like the most about it is that it does kind of push your boundaries a little bit in terms of what you like. And I use that expression acutely, because it's not as if you have to choose something that you just will have no possibility of liking. This is, you know, oh, I kind of like this. Maybe I'll consider that. And it's just a little bit different from what you're used to. And as a result, it opens up what you might accept as being a reasonable meal for breakfast or dinner.
Absolutely. And I think it's also a great tool if you're a person who doesn't really know how to cook and you're trying to learn a little bit, because they give you the ingredients, they give you all the instructions. It's very much a hands-on approach to cooking. So if you're someone who's...
It's literally hands-on. So I had to chop a chili pepper last night, and I wear contact lenses, and I forgot that I was going to have to take my contacts out and put them back in until after I had handled the pepper. I've had one previous horrible experience with that lasted for like 2 days. And fortunately, I survived unscathed with this one. Just a slight slight tingle when I put my contacts in this morning. Otherwise, I was all good. So just a reminder for all of you out there working with spicy food. You know, sometimes gloves can be your friend if you have to touch your eyeballs at any point in the next 2 days.
If you're looking for food and recipes to deliver to your home, please check out Blue Apron.
You can't move on until we get to the call to action. BlueApron.com/lacrosse. Come on, man. The / lacrosse is the most important part. When we dropped this the first time, I talked about how much pride I individually had in being a part of getting lacrosse on Blue Apron's radar. BlueApron.com/lacrosse.
Check it out, guys. But yeah, let's move on to the 12 o'clock game from Saturday. Notre Dame 14, North Carolina 13. But before we delve into the game, let's talk about what was probably the second most viral moment of the entire season. Bobby Gray shooting and literally breaking the metal off the pipe and busting the net.
It was unbelievable. I mean, there are so many different places that we can go with this. I immediately went to, is this the best net ripping goal in history? I really think there's only one comparison, and it's from 2010. Kyle Wharton, feet set against Towson, night game. I was there. I believe the Caps got eliminated that night from the postseason. I mean, certainly not an uncommon or unlikely occurrence, so very feasible that that one is correct. What's your take? Which was your vote?
I actually made a joke in the moment. I said, wow, that is the greatest shot that ever was. Like, I think we should cancel lacrosse after this, because that is the zenith and nothing will get better than that.
I mean, it really is. So here's my thing. I don't know. Is Bobby Gray left-handed?
I don't know either.
If he isn't, that is probably the best shot in the history of lacrosse, because for a multitude of reasons. The first is it's on the run. So already it gets a little bit of a nod versus a time and room set shot. Secondly, It pinged the corner. There's no question about it. I saw a criticism that it wasn't as impressive because it wasn't the net that was ripped. It was the attachment of the net to the side. Now, this was before the clarity was provided that the metal actually broke. But in that interim time when you were considering that it was just the string that attached the net to the pipe, That didn't discredit it all
that,
for you at
that
all?
That didn't discredit it all. It was all right. An amazing shot.
And then, yeah, so to your point, we come to find out, thanks to the Notre Dame athletic trainers, that it literally broke the goal. Like, the goal will never be the same.
just a wild moment. I loved it. My tweet on it went viral. I was a little surprised about that. But, yeah, definitely.
You were surprised that it went viral?
A little bit. I was like, what? Wow, this is awesome. But like,
come on, man, it's your job to be able to forecast virality. This is, if you didn't think that was going to go viral, I'm a little concerned, because that was so clearly one of the most viral moments of the season. It was just a question of whether or not this was going to capture the imagination more than a Joel Tenney fake flip.
Yeah. So I was watching it on my television. I was like, ooh, that'll go viral, you know? And then before I even like put it on Twitter, people are in my mentions like, Dan, please tell me you got that.
Absolutely, man. It was awesome. And not only that, it was the perfect reaction, too, because between the players on the field continuing to play the play out, but then the commentators knowing that it went through the net, it was just an absolutely excellent clip.
Yeah, it was great. Let's get into the specifics of this game. Because
I don't know what else there is to talk about. I don't understand why we have to talk about the rest of the game.
But Carolina did blow another fourth quarter lead in successive weeks with their season on the line. They must now win the ACC tournament as the number 4 seed to be eligible for the tournament. And even then, there's no AQ. It's still a long shot.
I don't think that Carolina blew this game as much as they did the Syracuse one for a number of reasons. The first being, I felt more like Notre Dame stole this one as opposed to what Syracuse did to steal that victory last week. You know, certainly being on the road had something to do with it. But more than that, I just felt like, you know, Notre Dame's defense really started to find its rhythm in the second half. And I think that to me was the deciding outcome of the game, because it's what you hear about all the time. Whenever you're trying to come back, it starts with getting stops. And I thought that Notre Dame was able to do that. And it's interesting because, you know, when you coach defense, when you talk about defense, typically you can do one of two things: emphasize the schematics or the tactics, which are typically a little bit easier to talk about, or you can talk about the mindset and the attitude and the passion that you play with. And there's probably schools of thought as to which is more important or which would be the 60-40 more important aspect of that breakdown. But I just felt like Notre Dame in the second half played with a lot more ferocity than they did in the first half.
That's fair. But I also would think that, you know, Notre Dame's defense didn't play as well as they could, because I feel like their shorties got exposed a little bit. There were 7 Carolina players that had a goal.
I'm not trying to argue that they played well. I'm just saying that I thought they played better in the second half than they did in the first half, because if they had reprised that effort, I didn't think that there was going to be much of a doubt about the outcome.
That's definitely true. And what did you think about Carolina's offense in this game? Because it does seem to be that game against Virginia seems to be a turning point for this team offensively. Metzbauer has basically taken his athletic middies, told them, when you get a short stick, invert behind the cage and try to be an initiator in that way.
I thought that it was a good plan. I mean, we talked about this on Friday in our IL Epic Game Day Live preview show, that it was going to require some stepping up from the young middies, and it was going to be acting against the freshman wall, trying to run through it as opposed to get slowed down by it. You know, we saw a nice goal from Justin Anderson that I thought demonstrated a little bit of that capacity. You know, I thought that, to your point, they have a consistent approach in terms of what they're trying to do now. Mm-hmm. Everything feels a little bit more cohesive and a little bit clearer. And ultimately, I think that is obviously really important. But to, I mean, it's almost as if how much does it matter at this point? Like, to your point, what is ahead for North Carolina? They have to win two games. If they do win these two games, they're probably in the NCAA tournament. But on the inverse, like, if they don't, obviously their season's over. And does it feel like it's just a little bit too, you know, it's a little too late? I thought that Timmy Kelly played better in this one. I thought that he showed a little bit more of what we were hoping to see heading into the season than we had, at most of the points up to this one.
Absolutely. I felt like in this game that Carolina's offense kind of did their job, did their part. And I felt like the turning point was the 3-goal run by Notre Dame in the fourth quarter. I was watching the replays, and it kind of feels like those goals are both avoidable and non-avoidable because they gave, you know, Perkovic a little bit of too much space.
They were man up for two of them, so yeah, keep that in mind.
Absolutely, man up for two of them. And then they didn't respect Collins on one of those man up possessions, and basically just said, all right, if you're not going to respect me, I'm going to take my shot, cans it. But, you know, Perkovic had his looks as both a shooter and a feeder in this game, and you kind of felt like, what could have Carolina have done defensively to prevent this fall?
When Notre Dame scored to go up 4-2 at the end of the first quarter, it was off of a Perkovic dodge. He drew a double, passed through the defense to a Mikey Wynn on the doorstep. You know, it culminated what I thought was a really impressive first quarter from Notre Dame that included that backhand rebound shovel goal from Wynn, the net ripping goal from Bobby Gray that may or may not have ended the game, and then obviously demonstrating, I think Quint said, it was the best pass he had ever seen Sergio Perkovic throw. And to be saying that about a senior who has on this, you know, accomplished what he has on the national championship stage over the course of time was really, really impressive. So I say that to say that what Carolina was able to do in order to battle back from that was additionally impressive. The variety of scoring, the fact that while Chris Cloutier had 4 goals, they didn't seem overly reliant on him. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, I mean, to build a 12-10 lead with 10 minutes to go and then, you know, give up 2 extra man or man down goals, excuse me. I agree with you. It told the story of the game, and in a very real way, might have told the story for the Carolina season. Now, that being said, William Perry got him back to tied with 5 minutes to go, just under 6 minutes to go. And at that point, it was a question of whether or not Carolina could, in my opinion, score in transition, because I thought that was going to be their best opportunity for a look down the stretch of the game. But obviously there just wasn't enough opportunities.
And going to the game winner by Brian Costabile, another kid who's having a great freshman year, it was almost the exact same play and same corner that Sergio Salcido beat Brian Balcom in North Carolina from the previous week. I was like, wow.
Which is also the same corner that Brian Balcom stopped Connor Kelly on in the national championship game last year. So I guess you could argue that it goes both ways.
Absolutely. Another interesting development from this game that we failed to mention yet is John Travisano and the wings for Notre Dame negated a strength for Carolina with Stephen Kelly, and they won 10 of 14 faceoffs. And I feel like if Kelly, you know, wins the majority of the faceoffs in this game, Carolina, their defense plays as they've kind of become expected to play, it's a completely different story.
Yeah, and that's interesting only insofar as what we have talked about for 5 years with Notre Dame's faceoff unit is that they try to play 3-on-3 more so than isolating and making it a 1-on-1 matchup. When PJ Finley is taking the draw, it feels more like what they're trying to approach from there. And certainly don't undersell. I mean, he went better than 50%. Notre Dame won 19 of 30 faceoffs in this game. It didn't feel to me like the possession advantage correlated to that. I don't know if you agree. It didn't feel like Notre Dame had 2/3 of the possession. I certainly think they had a possession advantage, just not to that extent. So I think that, you know, to my point, I was impressed by the way that I was impressed by Notre Dame's game plan. I was, you know, impressed by, to your, as you say, you know, John Travisano kind of coming in and having, as Christian Sweezy would put it, a star turn. You know, we haven't seen him have this level of success to this point this year. You know, and for Stephen Kelly, it kind of continues a season of hot cold, right? Like, yeah. Isn't that kind of what we've seen over the course of the year so far?
Absolutely. It was just a very interesting development. And one of the knocks against Notre Dame, you know, when people talk about their postseason chances, is this is a team that doesn't particularly excel at the faceoff X between PJ Finley and John Travisano. this is a very positive result going into the postseason next week.
Well, matchups make fights, and we've already seen Notre Dame face off against the other three, you know, potential opponents in the ACC tournament. So, you know, the results are going to be less indicated by this matchup and more by what we saw in the previous matchup. Now, that being said, maybe some trust in variety at the face-off X is now a little bit more reasonable for Notre Dame as they head into the ACC tournament. But then obviously, certainly, if they were to rematch against Carolina, you would expect to see some adjustments based on Saturday's game.
Yes, I think we'll save most of the ACC, you know, preview talk for your podcast with Quint coming in the next few days.
But we would be remiss not to talk about this game ended with Ryder Garnsey down with an injury. So that's a storyline to follow. As it looked like, I don't know. Did you get a read on what the injury looked like? Because to me, he was reacting as if it were an ankle, but the play suggested it was a little bit more of a knee. He was down on the ground for probably about the last 20 seconds or so of play, and then his teammates came to him afterwards. I haven't heard an update in the wake of that, so his availability going forward is still a question mark as far as I'm concerned.
And don't forget that Sergio Perkovic also got hurt on his shot. He did finish the game, but that is something, you know, that probably will linger down the road. All right, before we move into the second half of our podcast, we got to give another sponsor shout out, this time to Sideline Swap. Kyle loves Sideline Swap for his plastic and sometimes wooden fixations. But Sideline Swap is where lacrosse players buy and sell their gear, find deals up to 70% off on heads, shafts, helmets, and more, or snag unique gear from colleges and the pros. Sideline Swap also lets you sell old gear simply and securely, list in seconds, and they'll send you a prepaid shipping label when it sells. Visit SidelineSwap.com today to get started. That's SidelineSwap.com. If Kyle was here, I'm sure he would tell you to go on SidelineSwap.com. It's the opening weekend of the MLL this past week, and he said, go get your MLL gear on SidelineSwap.com.
Absolutely. This is not our MLL podcast, but no. Some interesting first opening weekend results, including a New York Lizards overtime victory in Annapolis against the Chesapeake Bayhawks, which, you know, to this point, as they're waiting on their NLL stars, certainly Lyle Thompson to return. Still worth keeping an eye on how these results shake out.
Absolutely. I believe every game in the MLL was decided by one goal this week. It's very interesting. Terry, before we delve into the rest of the weekend's results and get into our segments, we got a great guest this week for the In the Crease podcast, ESPN analyst Paul Carcaterra. Let's delve into my interview with him right now. The In the Crease podcast is pleased to welcome Paul Carcaterra, one of the most recognizable faces and voices in the sport of lacrosse. Paul, how are you doing today?
I'm fantastic. No complaints, man. No one listens if I did complain, so I'm good.
Paul, one question that seems to be asked to me a lot, you know, down the stretch of this season, is there a favorite or favorites to win the national championship this year? And if so, who are they?
Honestly, no shot, man. No one has any clue who the favorites are. Anyone who tells you that they do, they're lying, or they're just, I don't know, they've been hitting the head one too many times. I mean, if you look at the patterns of the season and all the teams that have kind of risen to the top echelon, they've all had major bumps in the road, and I'll even include Syracuse in that. And the reason being is, you know, they have the one loss, but, you know, 9-1 goal games. You beat a team like St. John's, and all due respect to St. John's, but you beat them by one goal. You beat Binghamton by one goal. You can't tell me that's a healthy number one, big, strong, powerful type of team that you go into the NCAA tournament feeling a lot of confidence if you're a Syracuse fan. And, you know, anytime we feel like another team might be turning the corner, they stub their toes. I mean, I think from a balance standpoint, Notre Dame might be the most balanced team. I'm still waiting to hear what's going on with Ryder Garnsey. It looked like at the end of that game against North Carolina, he got hurt. If he's hurt, that drastically changes their ability to hit you on multiple levels offensively. But I don't know. I've always liked Maryland, too. You know, they haven't won a title since 1975, but I love their senior class. And I think Rambo and Heacock are great leaders and calming forces, too, because of their personalities. I know you've spent some time with those cats, and I have as well. I kind of like what they stand for. But, you know, I'm not a betting man. I don't take any action on any sports. If I did in lacrosse, I wouldn't feel confident putting money on anyone.
Yeah, you mentioned Rambo and Heacock, and Heacock actually sat out the game on Saturday against Ohio State. And, you know, Maryland ends up losing that game. The Big Ten is kind of in flux right now. With, you know, Ohio State holds those victories both over Maryland and Johns Hopkins at home. You know, if they win next week, they got the number one seed in the tournament. That's in their house. How do you see the Big Ten shaking out with that tournament?
You know, it's really interesting. Last night, the game with Penn State and Rutgers, I thought that was not only just the biggest game in the Big Ten season, but that's a game that could alter the NCAA tournament and seedings and who's in and who's out. I mean, you put Rutgers in a spot now that they have to beat Ohio State this weekend if they want to advance to the NCAA tournament. I think if they do beat Ohio State, even though they're not in the Big Ten tournament, I think Rutgers will get in at large. I look at Rutgers in North Carolina in a similar situation where they have everything to play for this coming weekend. North Carolina goes into the ACC. I think everyone feels right now that the Tar Heels are done. I mean, there's no way you can tell me they can't win two games. I mean, they lost to Notre Dame by a goal. They lost to Cuse by a goal. They're certainly a team that can beat Duke on any given day. So don't be surprised if North Carolina runs the table in the ACC, but the Big Ten, man, I just think that's a little bit different. Like the ACC tournament sometimes is a little bit tough to figure out too, because the champs haven't really done well the last bunch of years down the stretch in the NCAA tournament. And it's been such a gauntlet. And I think we're finally seeing the Big Ten now approaching that gauntlet style, right? Because in the past, it's like, okay, you had Hopkins, you had Maryland the last couple of years. You kind of felt like it was going to go through there. But now Ohio State's really emerging. Penn State's better than they've ever been. So I think we're almost looking at the ACC now in the tournament in that gauntlet a lot like the Big Ten. So, you know, the Big Ten tournament, it's also a week later. So I almost think that gauntlet is even tougher one to figure out when it comes to the NCAA tournament. You know what I mean? So like you have the ACC tournament, you don't win the ACC tournament, you got a couple weeks left, and Notre Dame's been really good at that, resting up and making a run at championship weekend. Dude, this gauntlet in the Big Ten is at the level of the ACC, and it's a week closer to this to the actual tournament. This is a real slugfest heading into the NCAA tournament. So I think the power of the Big Ten is going to actually put some pressure on these teams come Big Ten tournament, and how well will they actually respond come the NCAA tournament, because it's closer than it is to the ACC, and now you have that same level of lacrosse. So in terms of the team shaking out, look, I really like Hopkins. I think Hopkins is a totally different team now that Kyle Maher has played with tremendous confidence. The one game in that stretch for Maher that, you know, the Hopkins team didn't win was Ohio State. He only had like three shots in that game. When they feed that kid and he gets into the action early, it's a really tough offense to figure out. And extra man, if you penalize the Jays, you're toast. I mean, and not just statistically are they the best in the country, but if you watch them in person, how quick they move the ball and how good they are, I just think this Hopkins team is really starting to peak at a higher level. They're swarming to the ball. Robert Kuhn's playing great on the wings now, helping out a one-legged Hunter Moreland. If I was to say one team that I feel really, really good about, it would be Hopkins, because I don't know the status on Heacock. I think he's a game changer and taking pressure off of Rambo. But I really like the Jays.
You also mentioned North Carolina having everything to play for. The ACC tournament is this weekend. And, you know, you've mentioned that the champs of the ACC tournament has not had as much success in the NCAA tournament. And it kind of feels like that this ACC tournament feels so much more wide open this year than in years past. I feel like every team going into it has a decent shot of winning. How do you see this one playing out?
I agree with you unequivocally. I mean, Quint and I were like kind of going back and forth in text, and he sent me over what teams are trending in one way for the ACCs. And honestly, like, you can take the four teams, shuffle it up in a box, pick one, and you can have a leg to stand on any of them, right? Syracuse, number one seed. So would it be the biggest fluke if they ran the table actually in two games and won the ACC? Of course not. Notre Dame, as I said before, maybe the most complete team in that conference. And we've never really seen them play super bad. I don't think we've seen them play their best, but every other team we've seen kind of two sides of them. North Carolina have the most to play for. I think, you know, this is an interesting team in Carolina too, because a lot of people talk about Pontrello being the difference maker in regards to their success offensively and allowing Cloutier to do certain things and Goldstock do certain things. You know, a lot of it is true, and they don't have that, like, alpha male big-time Dodger. These guys are getting their shots. It's not like, you know, their shots have been cut down in third. They're just not hitting the cage, too. Their shooting percentages are down, both of those guys on attack. I think if they find rhythm early, we've even seen spurts with that with Cloutier this year and Goldstock. They've had games where they found rhythm. They just have to do it differently. You know, they're not going to do it with a Pontrello. Tagliaferri probably has to be a little bit more of a dodging threat. He needs to hit the cage. He's been up and down statistically in terms of his ability to hit the cage. And then, you know, you look at Duke. Duke is a team I think everyone feels super good about, right? And, you know, they beat Notre Dame and they beat North Carolina. But, like, you look at their resume, and they've peeled off so many of these consecutive wins. But they really haven't gone through like a gauntlet of stretch where they've knocked off like two or three teams in a row. You know, they lost to Cuse up in the dome. I'm not sure I have a really, really good take on Duke right now, because I've seen a ton of their games, but I don't really feel confident one way or another. I think so much is put on Gutterding's shoulders, and I think he's fantastic. And from a production standpoint, he's like the most underrated player in the country. I think, you know, he's going to deliver and do some good things. But to me, their young midfield is the X factor. I mean, they roll out like four or five guys who are sophomores and freshmen. And this is a time of the year where it's tough to win with that many freshmen. Like, you look at all Duke's success down the road, and you had guys like Trapuka and Lawson, seasoned veteran middies who really, really got it done. The younger middies later in the season can tend to struggle. So I think that's something to look at this weekend for Duke. If Duke gets really good production from those young middies, Brad Smith and those kind of guys, they'll be really, really dangerous. But I think this is going to be a great measuring stick, not only to find out what Duke is doing right now, but heading into the NCAA tournament. Like, I just think that this group of young middies has a lot to answer for me personally.
Absolutely. So much up in the air, but whoever does win that tournament does carry a lot into the NCAA tournament. But Paul, you've also done so much work off the field with media and such, and Relaxing with Paul, I've got to say, has been one of the better things to happen so far this season. You know, it's been a smashing success. What was the genesis of this idea, and, you know, how have you gone about executing it?
You know, it's a great question. I'm a big time snowboarder. I snowboard as much as I can, and my kids like to snowboard a lot too. And the one place in this world where I think of things and some stick and some don't is on the chairlift. And this winter, I kind of reflect a lot of times on where I am in terms of just my personal life and professional life. And I try to like push things in regards to what more do I want. And it really came. It came in two kind of hits. One was the chairlift, but I think the chairlift got me to a spot, my mind wise, because of, you know, just some things earlier in the year. Like getting that Doyle Smith Award was a really touching moment for me, and it kind of cemented the fact that I have an opportunity to do something with this game and to really promote it and put people in a better light. So, winning that in December and then being on the chairlift a bunch of times, just to ask myself, what more can I do? And I think the one thing that the sport has really been lacking is getting to know the human interest stories behind the game. Like, who are these guys? Like, who is Matt Rambo? Who is Colin Heacock? Who's Connor Fields and Scott Marr? That one will be coming out next week. And that's one of my favorites too. You'll see a coach who thinks and does things completely different in a really cool, neat kid in Connor Fields. So I just felt like it was really important that the sport as a whole, the fans, the people, the players, the coaches deserve to have their stories heard. And, you know, I had no formal training in shooting video and editing. So my editing skills and my video skills are a little bit limited, but that is secondary to me in regards to the access that I have, and the ability to tell the story. So I just think I was driven by just trying to make a difference and putting it on my shoulders too. It's really easy to complain and say, we don't have this, we really need this. But you know what? Unless you go out and do it, the only way you can guarantee it getting done is if you do it yourself. And that's kind of just like everything in life, right? If you're going to sit there and hope things get done, or hope there's personal interest stories on some of these young guys like Pat Spencer and Ben Reeves and Coach Bresci and Lars Tiffany and Connor Fields and Scott Moore, like, you know, it could be a warm day in Scotland when that pops if you don't take the initiative and the leadership on your own. So I think that's kind of the way that I've looked at this whole thing. I just said, you know what? What does the sport need? What do I really love to do? And I really do love to tell stories and to be around people and just to kind of humanize them. So I just went out and I just did it. And honestly, like, as much as you said, it's a success for me mentally too. This has been so gratifying. I mean, I'm spending a lot of time doing this. I'm getting a little bit better with like the editing. I'm still really, really green. Like I said before, I kind of put some of the final touch polishing, really, really cool editing type stuff that people could work circles around me. And I just try not to compromise the access or the ability to really find out who that person is. And, you know, when you're spending time with these people, I often think too, like when there's less cameras and it's more basic, sometimes you get the best stuff because they're not weirded out by all the lights. And it's just kind of me, to be honest with you.
And that's a great lead into my next question. But first of all, I'm blown away that you came up with the idea on a snowboard chairlift. That's amazing.
Yeah.
But, the all access with you and Quinn with Duke and North Carolina. So much fun to watch. Were there any takeaways from that that weren't caught on camera?
Yeah. You know, I think the coolest thing for me was just spending time and talking shop with the guys too. There was a lot of things that were caught on camera in that light, but I just think like for me, it brought me back to the locker room, you know, my playing days at Syracuse and the fraternity. Like we saw a lot of pieces to the show that dealt with like certain ideas or certain principles based on an individual or getting to know a certain person or an aspect of the program. But I think the one thing that I took away that maybe we didn't see as much was like the fraternity feel of these guys. Like these guys are all in. North Carolina, Duke, and so many other teams out there. Like these, the band of brothers and how much time these guys spend and the laughs behind the scenes. Like to me, that was some of the coolest stuff, you know. Like at the end of the day, like Coach Bresci and Coach Danowski, Coach Caputo and Coach Matt Danowski and all of Bresci's staff, like these are just normal guys who really, really love the game. Our game's so pure. It's really, really organic from the sense that like the media is there, but it's never intrusive. So I think it allows a lot of these coaches like just to be normal dudes. And it's really cool to see. And I think that kind of exudes down into the locker room with the kids because yeah, there's pressure to win, of course, and these guys feel it. But I just think like the ability of the players to join together and to have fun and just those little things. Those are the things I miss the most. Like I look back at my career, like it's not a goal I scored or an All-American plaque or a national title. It's the laughs in the locker room and the friendships. That's why I always tell kids. I mean, you go on and you play lacrosse, regardless at what level, Division III, Division II, I, or club. You're going to be in a fraternity for life with these guys. Some of the best relationships ever. Those are some real, real takeaways. But also, the second thing I would say is the time commitment for these kids. We probably didn't get to see exactly what their commitment is, but like it's crazy. A lot more than 1997, 20 years ago when I graduated from Cuse. It seems like so much of their day is regimented. Where, you know, that's a lot to ask of these kids because they're not going off and playing in the NBA or the NFL. I mean, there's Major League Lacrosse for a lot of these guys, but they're not doing it because it's driven monetarily. Just slam-packed schedules, like really, really little wiggle room to kind of horse around. I'm sure they find time to do that, but, you know, it's few and far between compared to when I was a kid.
Now, Paul, I got to ask you this question, but it's been a source of controversy over the course of the season. But there is this deal with what you call performance sweatpants, and Quint so colloquially refers to as capri pants. Tell me about this choice of wardrobe.
Look, man, when you don't really care what anyone else thinks in this world, you become confident and you're in a place that is actually a pretty good mental space. That's kind of where I am right now at the stage of my life. I'm 41. The day I really care what Quint Kesnick thinks about my wardrobe, I'm really going to have issues. When I'm on the air, my style is my style. I would tend to say that when I'm dressing professionally, I try to pick out and find the best stuff possible that fits me, that's tailored to me, that's been kind of vetted through me and maybe my wife and a couple of other people that I consult with from a fashion standpoint. But when it comes to like workout gear, dude, it's all about comfort. It's all about lightweight stuff. I'm not wearing big old baggy shorts. I'm not wearing shirts that don't fit. I'm more in tune with like a European style than American style. If you were going around in Europe, people wouldn't look at you like you had three heads if you wore those. So those are actually soccer training sweatpants. They're not capri pants. You can call them whatever you want. I got a kick out of it. I also think, guys like Quint and Anish, they get caught up on it, but you're not even going to really hear me fire back too much about it because I like it. The day I call up Quint Kesnick to ask if I should wear a certain piece of clothing, dude, I'm out and done. I'm done. So he can have all the fun he wants with it. I can sit and rip on his, regular 40 fit off the rack blazer. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to let the dude wear what he wants. at the end of the day, I like him. And it wasn't just a one-off, man. I have multiple pairs of those. Back home in Ridgefield, Connecticut, I go to spin class a couple days a week. Depending on what season we're in, I might wear those. I also saw Colin Heacock when I was down there doing that relaxing piece. He had a pair of Under Armour sweats that were cut a little bit below the knee. I got a couple pairs of those. Yeah, man, it's all about comfort. I don't really care. Did you see my calves in that piece too?
Yeah, I saw you flexing. They were big calves.
Yeah, so I mean, you got the calves. You wear the pants, right? I'm sure a lot of people. I'm sure a lot of people had fun with that, but I'm good with it too because I like to harass people and get all over them. So you got to be willing to soak it on the chin too. And that's fine. I've been chirped so many times about those pants. So many times. What was your reaction to it? Be honest.
I mean, I just thought, well, first of all, I thought they were yoga pants, and then you kind of explained them, and I was like, oh, they're European soccer pants. I've seen those because I've lived abroad.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You'll see Cristiano Ronaldo training in those. You'll see Messi, all these guys. I think Rabel might have a pair, too, because he had my back when people were booching me.
I love the answer, Paul, but another source of chirping with you guys is Anish referencing your poor taste in movies. What have you say about that?
Okay, this is what everyone needs to know. Anish has a lot more time on his hands. He doesn't have like two screaming kids, and his hobbies are different than mine. Like my hobbies, like I said, I probably got 25 days in snowboarding this year. I was out west three times. Like, that's what I'm doing with my free time. Anish watches movies nonstop. I mean, just nonstop. So with that comes a level of confidence, and he's a bit of a snob when it comes to movies. Like, dude, if you want to have a conversation with Anish, you got to be, you got to be willing and ready for him to like look at you and like give you like that chuckle, like, oh, really? You haven't seen that movie? He got all over me about the Graduate earlier in the season. I will say, I have seen The Graduate with Dustin Hoffman.
Yes, I have.
Okay, yeah, I have never seen it, so I took his advice. It was an outstanding movie. It was an outstanding movie, and I'm glad I wasn't in his shoes when I was younger with Mrs. Robinson. That'd be a tough spot to be in, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the movies. Look, he also. You know, he's weird with some too. Do you watch Ray Donovan?
I do not.
Series. It's a really good series on Showtime. It didn't catch on to him. For him to really endorse something, it's it's got to be, you know, it's got to be big time. You know, he didn't like Johnny Dangerously. Have you ever seen Johnny Dangerously?
No, I have not.
Yeah, that's what he would always rip on me about, Johnny Dangerously, which is Michael Keaton back in the old days, grows up on the Lower East Side, kind of gets into some stuff with some gangsters, causes some commotion in the family. Hilarious, hilarious movie. His mother's a horrendous housewife from back in Ireland. Her name was Ma Kelly. Actually, we gave my mom that nickname growing up. My mom was a terrible housewife, unbelievable mom and great person, but horrible housewife. So kind of turned me into a neat freak. So I connect on Johnny Dangerously on multiple levels. But he didn't like that. He said it didn't hold up. The movie didn't hold up over time. So
maybe I'll check it out and be the judge of that one. My own personal
judge.
Yeah,
you're right. Look, keep in mind, I was like 16 when I was watching it and goofing around. It still has some lines that will pop from time to time out of my mouth. But yeah, it's not one of these movies. It's a game changer. I mean, you're into some of them, like the easy, like the Caddyshacks and the Animal Houses. You like that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm into a lot of that stuff.
Paul, you've been an absolute treat. You're one of the best dudes in lacrosse, a great hang. I really appreciate you coming on the show. You've been awesome.
Anytime, man. Be well.
The next game that we are going to discuss, another great one from Saturday night. Albany 13, Yale 12. The Great Danes rally from a 4-goal deficit in the fourth for the amazing comeback win. What was your take on this game, Terry?
Well, first of all, it was a little bit higher scoring than I anticipated. I think I was just kind of, even though all the indicators were that it was going to be a game with 25 or more goals, I was expecting to swim the opposite, kind of swim upstream on that thought. I think there were 6 goals scored in the first 5 minutes, and I was like, whoa, I was wrong on that one. And then the pace slowed down a little bit. I thought that the battle at the faceoff X was interesting and certainly lived up to the expectations. I thought that Aiden Hines guarding Connor Fields, who finished with 3 goals and 2 assists, was a really strong endorsement for the Yale coaching staff toward a freshman to give him that assignment. It wasn't as if they kept him on an island, but I did think that they expected him to be able to hold his own in the, kind of one-on-one situations. One of the overarching impressions, and this is true for the Penn State game that I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later on, but tremendous environment for a 7 p.m. start in Albany. I think that that's a reflection of a couple things. First, this team has continued to captivate that market, and obviously what Lyle and Miles Thompson established has been, or perpetuated, really. I mean, dating back to what Frank Resiteritz, Merrick Thompson, and Brett Queener established, it's so exciting to see that with these games played in their football stadium. It's a great venue. It's, as is the case with most of these, unfortunate that they can't put the camera on the opposite sideline and get the full crowd in the majority of the shots. That being said, really, really cool place and cool web stream to watch. I think that for Yale, once again, it's become clear that Ben Reeves was he was limited early in the season. He is no longer limited, and he is very, very dangerous. That was my takeaways. What was yours?
Yeah, the atmosphere is great when Albany scores a goal and the camera is shaking because the crowd is so loud. But definitely the surprise of the game for me was Connor Mackey going 16 of 29 against TD Ireland, who that litmus test against Maryland said, wow, this guy might be legit even as a freshman.
Right. Now, let's keep in mind, when you look at some of the other results that, Maryland has put up, particularly recently and particularly most recently against Jake Withers, this is not a dominant Maryland faceoff unit.
Yeah.
It does have some name recognition and some brand name to it. To me, I would say that says more about Connor Mackey than it does about TD Ireland. I think that even the Yale faceoff, Yale has been a little bit down facing off for the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
They, prior to that, had almost a 10-year run of really, really solid faceoff play. And it went through, it was probably like 4 or 5 guys over the course of that time. So I would say that, Mackey's return to that level, he's a top 10 faceoff win percentage guy, and probably also in terms of the FOGO ratings, is really significant for, what it means for both the Bulldogs' chances going forward, as well as the stability of that position. I mean, I think that's one of the storylines of Albany's season so far as well, is it's easier to win games when you're dominating possession, and it's easier to dominate possession when you're winning faceoffs at this rate. And so, you know, for Yale to not have to worry about that in the way that they had previously has been a huge luxury for that team this season.
And of course, we can't talk about an Albany game without mentioning Connor Fields. He did very much have a Tuorton winning performance, 3 goals, 2 assists, and I think more importantly, the game-winning calls turnover that led to the goal that won this game.
And I think that ultimately this was an even game. It was a game of runs, You know. So I think that for Yale to get out to an early lead, they were up 2-0, and then they did build another 3-goal lead. They were ahead 9-6 with about halfway through the third quarter. For Albany to continue to battle back, they didn't take a lead until they took the lead with 34 seconds to go and finish out the final score 13-12. It was so impressive to see this Albany team show the mettle to respond against a good opponent at home in a game that, while it helps for NCAA seeding purposes, you know, isn't nearly as important as some of the league matchups that they've played recently. And particularly given that they lost to Maryland, You could almost understand if this game didn't mean as much as it would have if they had beaten Maryland, because in that situation, they're almost assuredly a home, first round home game. And now they're playing for maybe a top 4 seed and a much easier opponent in the first round. Whether or not they beat Yale was going to have relatively little to do with how their season ends up and what ends up being their fate in the NCAA tournament. Yes, that win could help them host a first-round matchup, but I would still say that the odds are kind of against them. I expect them to end in that 9-10-11 range. It's been familiar territory for the Great Danes over the last couple seasons. But I do think that, that showed both the ability to come back down 4 goals, it was around 12-8, with 12 minutes to go, and then make a game-winning play late. It was an impressive showing out of just a team that's led by, you know, guys like Kyle McClancy. Bennett Drake had a great game. I thought his unassisted goal scoring was really impressive. Mm-hmm. He scored off the dodge a handful of times. Sean Eccles made a couple of nice plays in the middle of the field, and it all amounted to a team that really felt not only like senior-led in the sense that they weren't making a ton of mistakes down the stretch, but also senior led in the sense that it felt like they deserved to win, right? It was like we had played well enough that we deserved to win this game, and now we're going to take it from you.
Yeah, you mentioned the Bennett Drake. He had 4 goals and 1 assist, and also another great development in this game was Stone Sims limiting Reeves to just a goal. That, you know, has both positives and negative things to say about this game. But one thing that Quint Kesnick has mentioned on your podcast is that he feels like this team runs way too much through Connor Fields. And I actually feel like performances like this suggest the opposite of that. This is actually one of the more balanced Albany teams that we've seen in recent years, largely because of the way TD Ireland can perform at the faceoff X, but also the way that Connor Fields gets these complementary players into the action.
I think that that's a function of two things. The first being, as the season moves along, opposing defenses are going to start to take more and more risks to limit him because he is so productive and he's been so good. And so the idea that impacting or limiting Connor Fields directly correlates to our ability to win the game, it justifies those risks. The second thing is that whether we're talking about seniors or sophomores, as this season goes along, they are going to grow into their roles to contribute in more meaningful ways. And in this instance, particularly in the way of scoring goals, some of these guys have been contributors for 2, 3, 4 years. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's something to be said for, by the time late April rolls around, if you're not getting scoring, not just from 3, 4, 5 guys consistently, but then also 1 or 2 or 3 guys that maybe aren't consistently showing up every game, but have the capacity to show up on a rotating basis and help round out your scoring, then your recipe for May success is very limited. So in that sense, I would agree with Quint, but in the sense that Albany has showed the signs over the last 2 weeks of being able to rely on more guys than just Connor Fields, I would agree with you. Because certainly we saw that against Binghamton, when he was limited to just 3 points, and granted Albany, you know, was limited to 10, but they still controlled the game and comfortably secured a 10-4 victory over Binghamton in the middle of last week.
And what does this game say about Yale? Because I feel like it had some positives to say about this team despite the loss. You know, Reeves only 1 goal, but the rest of the guys on this team said, you know what, we don't need our star player to contribute in order to have a good game. Joey Sessa had a great game. Jason Alessi showed some great work up top. Well, you know, what were your takeaways for Yale in this game?
Yeah, I mean, Jason Alessi is an awesome player. He's another one of those guys that you expect to get better as the season goes along because he plays football. And so, you know, he doesn't necessarily have the fall reps that a lot of his teammates do. To me, it says they are a mid-teens team. And I know that you ranked them 6 last week, correct?
Coming off of that Brown win, I ranked them 10.
Yeah. So I would say the 10 is still even a little bit high. I think that if you were excited about this Yale offense or this Yale performance, started with that Connor Mackey performance, I think that was what differentiated it from previous outings. But to me, there are just too many unknown quantities, whether it be in rounding out that offense or probably in terms of their ability to lock down opposing offensive threats. You know, and they graduated so much and they lost a couple of guys due to injury coming into this season at the defensive end. And they haven't gotten consistent goalie play when Yale is great, they want to win games 12-8 or 10-6. I don't think that they can hold good teams to 6 or 8 goals. And I think that in these results against Maryland and Albany, that's what we've seen. Even the Brown game, Brown got to 12 on them. Yeah. So ultimately, I think that that is, to me, what the future holds. Can their defense continue to improve, not only heading into the Ivy League tournament and once again, you know, doing what they do in the Ivy League tournament, which is secure the AQ. But then if you transition into, you know, a first round NCAA tournament matchup, you're not coming in with the hype that you did last year. You know, you've accomplished a lot of your goals, and now you get the opportunity to play spoiler, which I think is the role that they're most likely to fill.
Very interesting take. All right, Terry, let's move into the second half of the podcast, which is filled with segments. We're going to do the same segments we do with Kyle. So you're going to have to do your own little spin on them.
Uh-oh.
But the first one we're going to dive into is Tawara Watch. There was actually some very interesting TV takes on the Tawaraton, you know, race, so to speak, this year. I'm going to give you my 5 finalists right now. My number one is still Trevor Baptiste, winning 75% of his faceoffs. They're killing teams right now. 2, Connor Fields. 3, Matt Rambo. 4, Pat Spencer, because Loyola is all of a sudden back in the postseason race. And then 5, even though he had a quiet game against Syracuse, I still think Sergio Salcido is the top middie in the country and is deserving of a finalist spot. But I will say this. If there was a 6th spot, I think right now I would put Jake Withers in there.
Yeah, that's really that's a bold take. That is a bold take. Now, granted, Ohio State is 12-2. They're a top 5 team by RPI. If you're going with the best player on the top 5 teams, you can make a real argument. That's one of the beauties of Ohio State. They don't necessarily have a clear-cut best player. One of the guys that has rocketed up the charts for me in that conversation of best player on a top 5 team is Justin Gooderding. He has 72 points to this point in the season, so he is among the top 5 scorers. So I'm with you on Baptiste, Fields, Spencer, and Salcido, but I would replace Rambo with Gooderding right now.
And that's a fair point, because I feel like Gooderding is probably one of the most slept on excellent players in the entirety of Division I right now.
And there are a couple of reasons for that. The first being, I think Duke in general is slept on. Mm-hmm. Because they started the season with a loss to Air Force, I think, and because they didn't have Demar Klass and Miles Jones, folks in our position, even fans, kind of felt like, all right, well, let's wait until Duke can show us who they are this year. We're coming off of 2 first-round NCAA tournament losses. This feels like a very traditional Duke team. Mm-hmm. I think that as it relates to these types of awards, there's always been a predisposition away from the Duke goal scorer, you know, dating back to the Zach Greer, who I believe was a Twerton finalist, but Max Quinzani was not, Josh Dian was not, but those guys were instrumental into those teams' success. And while Gooderding isn't necessarily a one-to-one comparison there, because I think he does handle the ball a little bit more, I like him because I think he's really close to the emotional center of this team. I think he's a leader of them offensively. There are so many young guys contributing at both ends of the field that I think Gooderding is complemented by Kyle Rowe facing off and Danny Fowler in goal. That to me is the core. And I think, you know, there isn't a huge gap either between Gooderding and Bruckner in terms of what they bring to the table. But because Gooderding has the better numbers to this point, I think he's the one that gets the nod as kind of like the Duke representative.
Do you have any other thoughts on finalists right now?
Well, no, I will hone that in over the course of this week as I plan to do a Player of the Year watch for Wednesday in anticipation of the Twerton nominee list getting knocked down to 25 on Thursday. You know, I think that to me, the most interesting question is how legitimate is Connor Fields' candidacy and how much does his resume depend on Albany winning? Meaning that, you know, at this point, I would say they're a bubble in if they don't win the America East. Obviously, that's considering the fact that one of those at-large spots will have been quote-unquote stolen. So the question is, can they replace it or reclaim it? I think the answer is more likely than not, yes. If they win the America East AQ and they end up putting themselves in a position for a top eight seed, I think there's no question that he's a number five, you know, a top five guy. But then the question becomes, all right, well, now that you've secured your spot as a top five guy, is he going to win it? And that's, to me, the most interesting question because he will have such better numbers than everybody else that will someone, whether it's by virtue of their team's performance through the NCAA tournament and Memorial Day weekend or some sort of really late hot streak, steal the award from him. It's not to say that, you know, Connor Fields is an undeserving candidate. I just think that compared to the other guys heading into the season that we've watched over the last 5 years, he will have come the farthest. Because even though he was a top 10 guy heading into the year, I almost feel like there is this idea that, yeah, he deserves to be in the top 10 consideration, but he's not going to win. Now I think that he's the bona fide favorite. And the question is there anybody that can take it from him?
Yeah, and a big part of the Tourton, you know, criteria is postseason success. He would have to get to the quarterfinals, I feel like, for him to win, because every Tourton winner has made at least the quarterfinals, and 12 of the 16 winners have made the Final Four.
I think that one of the interesting, you asked about finalists, one of the interesting guys is Sergio Perkovic, because he's been maligned for being too one-dimensional, just a goal scorer, and really being the beneficiary of the reputation established from what he's been able to do in NCAA championship games. So that's helped him to things like first team All-America finishes, despite not necessarily having that quality of a season. Well, the last 3 to 4 games, he's had that type of season. And so he almost has to battle against a negative reputation, that being that he's been the beneficiary of a positive reputation. The worm has turned in a positive way for Sergio Perkovic, and I'm just curious as to whether there's enough time for him to kind of clamber his way back into the conversation.
Great thoughts. Check out Terry's post on Wednesday. Let's move into Weird Watch of the Week. Terry, for me, it was actually a weird week of watch. There was so much stuff that I just caught my eye this week. I'm going to start with a coworker of ours, Caroline Darney, did what was called the Dark Side Challenge down in Orlando. And I woke up on Saturday morning to a litany of Snapchats of her detailing the race. It was a very, very interesting little race. It was held at Disney World. Basically, she ran a Star Wars theme 10K on Saturday and then a half marathon on Sunday. That's 19.3 miles. So wow, first of all to that. But she's in her Snapchat, she's going through this race, and there are basically Star Wars characters on the side of the race, like waving at the runners, say, hey, come take a picture with me. And I'm just like, how did I not know about this? And two, where can I sign up?
Okay, that is the definition of the Weird Watch of the Week. I can't imagine. I can't imagine what must have been going through your mind. Or maybe not yours because you're a Star Wars fan, but like if you were a friend of Caroline's on Snapchat and you didn't know that she was doing this and you just woke up and watched that story, like how mind-boggling would that be?
No, I was like
Weird Watch of the Week. It was like
the Hall of Fame Weird Watch of the Week. But I've got so much more weird watches. Not really weird, but All Access with Paul and Quint on Wednesday was great. I actually thought very interesting to see that Paul went 4 of 6 shooting against Quint. Quint looked a little cold. He was also shooting against tennis balls. Come on, man.
That was a little weird, only insofar as like the protective element. You mentioned the tennis balls thing. I don't know, man. I thought that it would have been better if we had gotten Quint into a chest protector and had him fully suited up and warmed up. But I agree with you. Quint didn't necessarily. He owned it. He owned it in our podcast on Friday. He didn't put his best foot forward. And he also didn't move his feet enough, he said. He literally did not put his best foot forward.
Yes, and of course, there's still a lot of controversy surrounding Paul's apparel choices.
Yeah, what's your take on the Caprice?
I'm going to talk to Paul about that. So
we're going
to
hold off on
that. We'll hold off on that. And then I watched El Clasico this weekend. Messi scoring his 500th goal with about 10 seconds remaining before the ref blows the whistle. Incredible. That's not really weird. Great broadcast observation, though, was from the Notre Dame-Carolina game. Once again, everybody's Canadian delicacy comes up in the broadcast. Poutine. Shout out to Ryan Boyle for knowing what it is.
like the actual ingredients or just the idea and concept?
I would say both, because me and Kyle talked about this, where Anish and Quint, you know, brought it up during their broadcast of Virginia, North Carolina, and they were both perplexed as to what poutine was.
Yeah.
And then Ryan Boyle was like, oh, man, poutine?
Yeah.
Canadian delicacy.
Well, I think MLL players have the benefit of having played in Hamilton against the Nationals for however many years they were in existence. And as a result, they got to experience poutine whenever they played there. Not only that, but Boyle was in the NLL for however many years, and so he was traveling all over Canada scarfing down some poutine.
So yeah, shout out to Boyle. I feel like this is not the last time we will hear of poutine on the broadcast.
Yeah, no, I hope that it is.
All right, Terry, let's move into the movers and shakers. I actually don't talk to you very much about how you vote, but me and Kyle have conversations about it all the time. I want to hear your thoughts, but I'll give you mine first. The only big mover for me really was Ohio State. They actually moved to number three for me, and I'm largely pinning that on the way that, you know, face-off victories tend to correlate with victories in general, the way this season has panned out. So I really like Jake Withers. I moved them to three behind Denver. And then the only other big mover for me was Hopkins moving into my top 10. That romp against Michigan, which we'll talk about, was impressive.
So I don't know whether it's unique or not, but I have a couple of like things that are not hard and fast, but that I try to adhere to. The first is I have tremendous respect for a team that's undefeated. My argument is that we don't know what their ceiling is. Without seeing a team lose, you don't know how they can or will lose. So, you know, obviously we don't have any undefeated teams left. I don't have to worry about that. But even if I didn't think that Hofstra was the best team in the country and they were the last undefeated team, I was gonna rank them number one. And there are some folks who have a problem with that, so be it. The other thing is my poll week to week tends to be pretty static. I only really fluctuate teams after they lose. So if the top 10 teams all win, but they do so in a variety of ways, you know, overtime versus a bad team versus blowing out a good team, I tend not to shuffle those rankings at all. So this week was the most continuity or consistency that we've seen in, or that I have ranked my teams over the course of a 7-day period so far this season. IQ's number one, Denver number two, and Duke number three. Albany jumped two spots by virtue of the win over Yale, but that was largely a function of Maryland losing.
Yes.
So one of the things that stood out to me, and it was difficult to kind of work my way around this without totally raising the white flag on my poll the week prior, is that there are a tremendous number of teams ranked behind teams that they've beaten. So I have Maryland ranked behind Albany, Ohio State ranked behind Maryland, Hopkins, Notre Dame ranked behind Ohio State and
Maryland.
Yeah. And so, you know, it continues on down the list. Nova, Yale is ranked behind Nova. So that was problematic. Loyola is ranked one spot behind Towson. That was problematic just in the sense that there's no better indicator of how two teams stack up against one another than the head-to-head result. But at this stage in the season, I don't think that's what the poll is meant to reflect, because it's not simply analyzing a series of games. It's taking a whole
body
matrix
work
of games, yeah, and trying to understand what it means about who you think both has the better performance in terms of the better body of work, like you just said, and then also, if they were to play today, who do you think would win?
Absolutely. And I feel like form comes into so much of that. All right, Terry, let's dive straight into the scoreboard rundown. This was a game that we had actually planned to talk about in depth, but turned into a blowout kind of. Penn State 13, Rutgers 7. You know, Gerard Arcari recovers from his struggles in Big Ten play, and Penn State dominate the faceoffs, play with a ton of energy, run what looked to be a very flat Rutgers team off the field.
Not only that, but Dixon made this comment during the broadcast, and I totally agreed with it. Penn State looked so athletic, particularly in the offensive end, particularly Grant Amend. It just looked like between how bouncy he was and how explosive he was behind the cage, that it didn't matter what the defensive matchup was going to be. Penn State was going to get looks and draw slides because of how many steps Grant Amend was going to be able to get on whoever was guarding him.
Absolutely. Penn State's still a dangerous offensive team, in my opinion. They wrap up a spot in the Big Ten tournament. Another Big Ten result was Hopkins 19, Michigan 9, an absolute romp for Hopkins on homecoming. Excellent game from Kyle Marr, 3 goals, 6 assists, and what many people call a breakout game for Cole Williams with 2 goals, 1 assist, lots of reps. Another important development in this game is they took Hunter Moreland off early after it was clear that they were kind of going to coast in this game. He'll be fresh for Maryland.
And you're right. I mean, obviously, that was huge in a handful of their positive results so far this season. To me, the big takeaway is when you analyze their last 5 games, Kyle Marr has 27 points. In one of those games, he was held at 2, and they lost. And in the other ones, he exploded, and they did not lose. So I think that you have spent a handful of minutes or maybe hours at this point talking about the third attack spot for Johns Hopkins, and I don't see there being any conversation. The question isn't Kyle Marr or not. The question is, how do we make sure that Kyle Marr has a big day? It's interesting because I'm not sure that it's totally necessary to facilitate him. It's really a function of how well is he shooting and how much will the defense attract. How much of the defense's attention can he attract because of how well he's shooting?
Absolutely. Another 1-goal game for Syracuse as they survive Binghamton 9-8. The Bearcats impressed in this game. Their leading scorer, Tom Moore, 5 goals. And you kind of wonder, is Binghamton a possible bid stealer in the America East?
Yeah, I think they are. They lost by 6 goals to Albany, who would be the America East favorite. I saw them lose by a goal to UMBC last Saturday, so 10 days ago now. But that being said, they come across like such a well-coached team. They're mm-hmm. not, they don't make mistakes. They don't really beat themselves. It's the type of team that you can expect to rebound and play well in the conference tournament because they just have to play their game. I know that's a cliche, but on the other hand, it's an adage, and it means that like just adhere to the game plan, and whether or not we're good enough to win is why we play. But if we adhere to the game plan, we're probably going to give ourselves an opportunity to win. You mentioned Tom Moore, and there's no question. I mean, he's one of the nation's leading scorers, I believe, ranked number 6 right now in terms of points per game. But Tanner Cousins is at 53% in net, and I feel like he's been incredibly solid for this team. And as a result, even though they're on this 3-game losing streak, a pair of 1-goal losses in there, and they're probably going to get an opportunity to rematch against Albany. There's still a lot of questions, not necessarily in the tournament field, but I do believe there's questions in terms of the seeding for the America East, as Binghamton, Stony Brook, and UMBC are all 3-2 right now. It's going to be really fascinating to see how this finishes up, particularly given that Binghamton heads to Stony Brook in the regular season finale in the America East.
Another game that really screwed things up, so to speak, was Fairfield 9, Towson 8. Fairfield hangs on. Now Hofstra, Towson, and Drexel are all in the running to host the CAA tournament, depending on how things play out next week.
This is the definition of spoiler. Fairfield had high expectations coming into the season. It has not gone according to plan. This was their opportunity to really, kind of put someone back on their heels, and that's exactly what they did. They jumped out to a lead. It kind of reminded me, I wasn't able to watch this one, but following it from afar, it reminded me a little bit of the Delaware Rutgers game in the sense that Delaware got a great performance out of their goalie. Tyler Baring made 17 saves in this game. They built an early lead, and then they just hung on throughout, and they were able to close out a close victory.
The final game before we wrap this one up, back on Friday night, feels like a million years ago now, Loyola 14, Army 6, the Greyhounds romp, and they're now hosting the PL tournament. You got to think that they're the favorites in the Patriot League right now, considering that they're playing on their home turf.
They're 8-5 overall, 6-2 in the Patriot League. And yeah, I mean, I think that there are a handful of things to take away from this one. But for me, having seen Loyola beat Army a handful of times over the last 3 to 4 years, it just feels like that's a matchup that the Greyhounds feel comfortable with and feel good about. So obviously, neither team knows who they're playing yet. We're going to have to go through the Patriot League quarterfinals on Tuesday before they can find that out. But it'll be fascinating to see if they do rematch, to what degree can Army adjust and try to slow down a Loyola offense that put 14 goals on them. That's not going to be an easy task. The Black Knights are 10-3, but they had not let up that many goals. They only let up 13 to Syracuse, and that was almost you know, 2 months ago at this point. So this was a little bit of a shock to the system. I will say that Army's defense had let up 10 goals in 3 consecutive games, you know, after having only let up double digits twice before that. So seems like there's been a little bit of a regression out of that unit.
That's all we have for you guys today. I got to give a shout out to Terry for filling in for Kyle in a stitch. So thanks for that, Terry.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Dan. I really appreciate it.
So next weekend should be great, Terry. You know, both the Patriot League and the ACC tournament plus Maryland Johns Hopkins.
Oh, it's going to be. I mean, it's one of the best weekends of the year for college lacrosse fans. There's no doubt about it. There's so many games between the Friday Sunday action, and then obviously some rivalries. The end of conference tournament or conference regular season play usually means a handful of conference rivalries are lined up. It's going to be a great weekend of college lacrosse.
And we want to remind you guys to listen into the other podcast, one that features Terry himself. Listen to the D-Fly and Dixie podcast, either available on Tuesday or Wednesday, and then the Quentin Foy podcast on Friday. And remember, if you like the show, please give feedback, please tell a friend, and please subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at DanAbram2423. Thank you for listening, guys.
Inside the Cross Podcast.